Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees. The SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org, and URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, President Obama sweeps through California, scooping up cash, ordering out dim sum, and rallying the base. But can he overcome voter disappointment? Plus, the Noise Pop Indie Music Festival turns 20.
Keeping it about the fans and the music, you know, it hasn't become like a really scary industry type deal like South by Southwest or some of the other festivals have become.
Also filling a shortage of Spanish-speaking doctors by recruiting in Latin America. And back to the future in Mendocino County, cultivating heirloom fruits and vegetables.
Some of these varieties have been kept in people's families for 7, 8, 10 generations, and you can't buy them. And we carry some seed varieties that no one else has.
It's the California Report. Well, the presidential primary is still 3.5 months away, but you wouldn't know it from President Obama's reelection campaign sweep through California this week, starting Wednesday in Los Angeles and Orange County, ending up in San Francisco Thursday.
The President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Kicking off a fundraiser at Masonic Auditorium, the president skipped Hail to the Chief, making his entrance to a hipper sound. Buoyed by rising poll numbers and infighting among Republicans, Obama even found something to laugh at when pro-environment hecklers interrupted his speech.
Folks are not shy about sharing their ideas in San Francisco. Yeah, it's fun.
Senior political writer Carla Marinucci is covering the presidential campaign for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she's with us here right now. Hi, Carla.
Hi, good to be here.
Let me just ask you a general question. You've been covering these campaigns for a long time. How does this week's appearance by President Obama, how does it compare with, you know, past presidents as they've swung through California?
Scott, I think it compares in one way, the bottom line. These trips by Obama in California have really been all about money. It's been striking how little public events, how few events unpaid where just average citizens can see him. Those just don't exist. And I think it goes to the presidential campaign and the cost of it. But this year, particularly, it also goes to the influence of those super PACs. The Obama campaign knows it has to raise $1 billion. They know what they're up against with the Republicans. And they are focusing on the fundraising with laser vision. And this is their 10th trip to California. And it has been all about the Benjamins.
Does it also say something about the differences in the people, in the men, Barack Obama versus, say, Bill Clinton or George W. Bush?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Clinton, who I've covered here in California, used to go up and down the state and would do things like actually lay the wires for the internet and have big public events. George W. Bush, although he never actually set foot in San Francisco, did go to area events on the peninsula and other places in California. And here's another big difference. The media was allowed to cover those events, particularly local media were encouraged to cover those events.
Well, his trip comes as the economy seems to be perking up a little bit, and he's had a bit of an uptick in the polls. And I want to just play a clip from his appearance at Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco Thursday night, where he was talking about the economy and, in particular, manufacturing.
I want to make sure the next generation of manufacturing isn't taking root just in Asia or Europe. I want it taking root in factories in Detroit and Pittsburgh and Cleveland and California. I don't want this nation to be known just for buying and consuming stuff. I want to be known for building and selling products all over the world.
Carla Marinucci, California has been bleeding manufacturing jobs to states like Arizona over the past years. There was an article just recently in the New York Times, Steve Jobs, before he died, telling the president that Apple manufacturing jobs aren't going to come back to the U.S., much less California. Is that just an applause line, or does the president really believe it, and do people believe it when they hear it?
I think we've seen this week the president and the White House really want to emphasize this issue of jobs. They know that this matters, particularly in Silicon Valley, in Northern California, where we've seen iPad, iPhone, and all those jobs going to China. It isn't just an applause line. It matters very much to audiences. This is an area I think that's very sensitive to the president. He wants to pound this issue, and he's now getting his surrogates here in California, still one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, to talk to folks in the Central Valley, in Southern California, in other areas that are still really hurting in California.
You covered, of course, the 2008 primary, which was epic in California, Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama. And the theme of his campaign was hope and change. There was so much optimism and idealism in that campaign. Here's something he said at Masonic Auditorium again Thursday night in San Francisco. Let's hear it, and I'll come back and talk about it.
And I said in 2008, I'm not a perfect man, and I will not be a perfect president. But I promised you then that I would always tell you what I thought. I would always tell you where I stood, and I would wake up every single day fighting for you as hard as I know how. And I have kept that promise.
Carla, to what extent, I don't remember him ever saying he wasn't perfect, but I'll take him at his word. But to what extent is there, is the campaign dealing with that sense of disappointment that he didn't quite turn out to be the president they hoped he would be?
And there is a sense of disappointment. I mean, we saw out in front of the Masonic several hundred protesters, most of them on the left. Groups, anti-drilling groups, environmental groups, all saying he's not living up to the promises. I think the only thing they have going for them, and one of the major things they have going for them, is the Republican side is in such disarray.
Well, let me ask you about that. To what extent are the Republicans in California worried about what's happening now in the Republican primary? It looked like Romney was going to sew it up. He's a pretty good fit for California, but Santorum, not so much.
Absolutely. The presidential race on the Republican side is definitely of concern to Republicans, if only because the latest Cooks report shows now 13 congressional districts in California now may flip or be up for grabs. Nancy Pelosi is saying at least four and maybe more, she expects, are going to flip Democratic. And at the Democratic convention recently, the statewide convention, Democrats were totally fired up that they are going to have Speaker Pelosi back in office after the November election.
And so the Republicans need to have some enthusiasm for whoever's
That's
at
right,
the top of the
down ticket.
Ticket.
The down ticket is what they're worried about. At this point, the race is so in flux. We're going to see Newt Gingrich in California. A lot of them are going to be here looking for money. As all of these candidates are. But the fact is what they can't manufacture or get so easily is the enthusiasm. And on all sides, I think the Republicans are worried no matter who they support.
Carla Marinucci, senior political writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This week, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa was named chair of the Democratic National Convention, where President Obama will be nominated for a second term. More evidence of how important Latino voters are becoming. As the Latino population grows in California, so does the need for Spanish-speaking doctors who understand the culture. Problem is, few Latinos graduate from medical schools here. But as KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill tells us, the UCLA School of Medicine has found a possible solution.
¿Y cómo ha estado?
Mejor, me
bien,
siento mejor. ¿Sí?
Sí,
gracias.
Porque la vi la vez pasada, la vi hace en diciembre, ¿verdad?
Blanca Campos is a doctor at the Wilmington Family Health Center, about 20 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. Most of her patients are Spanish speakers who struggle with English if they can speak it at all.
Most of them are illegal, some are legal. Most of them don't have jobs, and especially because of the recent economic problems, you'll see a lot of patients that have last year insurances and are looking for clinics like these to help them with basically their basic needs.
Campos is a 38-year-old from Belize. She's among three dozen native Spanish-speaking doctors handpicked by UCLA to help fill California's shortage of bilingual and bicultural Latino doctors. The UCLA program, offered through the university's Department of Family Medicine, is the only one in the nation to specifically recruit Spanish-speaking med school graduates from Latin America.
Why is it important to have somebody like you in the clinic who is a native Spanish speaker?
Because, we understand how they grow up, we understand certain terminology that they use in Spanish that may not be in medical books, but we've heard it before and we understand what it means.
Without doctors like Campos, the ache or pain that led to the clinic visit can get lost in translation. And that often means wasted dollars and poor medical care for many native Spanish speakers.
It leads to misdiagnosis and misunderstanding and errors and often a tremendous amount of overtesting.
Dr. Patrick Dowling is chairman of UCLA's Department of Family Medicine. 6 years ago, he started the International Medical Graduates Program that operates solely on private grants and donations. The program provides stipends for resident doctors as they study for their U.S. medical exams. In exchange, the doctors commit to practicing medicine for up to 3 years in California's low-income communities. Dowling says this need is crucial, especially as only about 100 Latino students graduate from California's med schools each year.
And it's not clear how many of those are fluent in Spanish or have ever lived in or understand that culture.
Dowling's colleague, Dr. Michelle Bolot, is executive director of the program that each year admits a dozen or so doctors who meet narrow criteria.
Those that were born and raised in a Latin American country, who have worked in the United States and have learned to speak the language with some level of fluency.
Doctors who apply to the UCLA program must be U.S. citizens or legal residents. For many potential candidates, that can mean working for years at jobs unrelated to medicine. Bolot says one doctor who applied for legal residency had to work as a bookbinder to earn a living. Another made tamales, and yet another worked as a maid.
She was Doctora Payon, and when she got over here, she was somebody's house cleaner.
Colombia native Ingrid Sarmiento is among the newest batch of UCLA international residents. She came to California under political asylum after receiving death threats for providing medical care to a rebel. Now, she says, she's eager to show her gratitude to the U.S.
The United States has been a great support for me, and I want to give them back, and I'm going to be a great physician, and I'm going to help people, that's for sure.
And Sarmiento's help is certain to become even more necessary as California's Latino population, now at 37% of the state's total, continues to grow. UCLA's Dr. Dowling says it's his hope that all California med schools will eventually adopt his program as a way to meet the need for bicultural Spanish-speaking doctors around the state. So far, though, Dowling says only medical schools in Texas, Illinois, and Florida are looking into it. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Los Angeles.
For the past two decades, the Noise Pop Festival in San Francisco has grown from a handful of indie bands at a single venue to more than 100 music events across the city. Over the years, Noise Pop has launched careers for unknown artists and reunited music legends. As the festival turns 20, Deirdre Kennedy takes a look at what keeps Noise Pop fresh.
When Kevin Arnold started the Noise Pop Festival in 1993, he was fresh out of UC Berkeley and had just started booking and promoting shows. He had no idea he had just created a landmark event in San Francisco's indie music scene.
I'd say it was started pretty much on a whim, without any explicit goals except for trying to sell a bunch of tickets on one night at the end of January.
There's way more people here than I thought there'd be here, so I'm really happy about it.
Basically called all of my favorite bands up and said, you guys should play together and we'll call it a festival.
Seattle band The Fastbacks were one of six that shared the bill at the Kennel Club that first night. For the first couple of years, Arnold mainly booked music that fit the strict definition of noise pop, a style that grew out of the 1980s punk rock movement, with bands like Sonic Youth, The Pixies, and Husker Du. But after a few years, the festival expanded to include a broader range of styles, including electronica, hip-hop, Americana, and folk music. And in an industry that's traditionally been known as something of a boys' club, noise pop has featured a growing number of influential female artists, like Cat Power, Joanna Newsom, and San Francisco's Tao Nguyen. You stay and see what becomes of us. Shake, 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 shake. With music legends like Yoko Ono playing the festival, being an underdog is no longer one of the criteria for noise pop performers. But festival co-producer Jordan Curlin says there is a common thread.
You know, when you say indie rock or independent music, you know, it's no longer about you have to be on an independent label or be self-releasing. I think it's more about, you know, an approach to your craft and a spirit that you bring to what you're doing and a certain level of industriousness.
Years ago, bands like Death Cab for Cutie, Modest Mouse, The Shins, and others relied on college radio, fringe publications, and word of mouth to build their fan base. But internet music distribution and social media have given emerging artists much more exposure and drawn bigger audiences.
For us, every year it surprises us which shows sell very quickly. Because we're looking at, like, well, how do people know about these, you know, this band or that band? And it is because of, you know, something that has nothing to do with what's going on in San Francisco or the Bay Area at this moment.
Noise Pop has also expanded its agenda to include cultural events like DIY workshops, film screenings, and a bounce lesson conducted by New Orleans artist Big Frida. Bounce to the floor, tune it up, hot, hot, go, let's go, go, get back now. Despite its size, Noise Pop has maintained its raw and intimate atmosphere, says Bob Reed, frontman of the band Overwhelming Colorfast, which plays a reunion set at this year's festival.
Kevin's done a great job in Jordan of keeping it alive and keeping it fresh and invigorating year after year and keeping it about the fans and the music. You know, it hasn't become like a really sort of scary industry type deal like South by Southwest or some of the other festivals have become.
Photographer Peter Ellenby, who's photographed hundreds of noise pop shows, says the festival has also forged deep connections among the fans and musicians who take part year after year.
It's more about people, really, more than individual, like, moments of rock grandiosity or anything like that. There's been some amazing shows, don't get me wrong, but it's more the community and the friendships and the love that it's given me. That's what I love about the Noise Pop Festival.
That love extends to his home life. Ellenby met his wife, Janae, who's also a music photographer, at a Noise Pop event in 2003. They now have a 5-year-old daughter who will be tagging along to some of the Noise Pop events this year. The Noise Pop Festival runs from February 21st to the 26th in San Francisco. For the California Report, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
During his career, San Francisco writer Leslie Tenorio has gathered up a series of prestigious fellowships and awards, including a pushcart prize. Now, the talent that's won him so much acclaim is on full display in Monstrous, a collection of stories set among Filipinos and Filipino-Americans, where loneliness and love are major themes. Oscar Villalone has this review.
Even in an age of instant communication, we shouldn't forget there are still gulfs that separate us. Continents of loneliness, perhaps even regret, stand between us and those we love, whether they live on the other side of the international dateline or just on the other side of the Bay Bridge. In Monstrous, Leslie Tenorio gently but precisely uncovers all the ways in which people suffer longing and, in some cases, still find reasons to hope. These 8 stories, set in the Philippines and in California, cover a range of decades and a spectrum of people. There are late 60s horror movie directors and 1940s hotel employees, modern-day waitresses, and present-day psychic surgeons. One of the traits making Tenorio's work such a delight is how he's able to convincingly render all of those unalike characters from so many eras. Because of that, he's able to harvest the bounty of literary richness from his chosen plot of land, the Filipino experience. In The Brothers, a recently divorced man's rocky relationship with Erica, his transgendered sibling, turns into a search for redemption upon Erica's unexpected death. Perhaps too late, the older brother is finally presented to the life and the friends she had made for herself in San Francisco. The story, The View from Culiacan, takes us into a leper colony where a young Filipina-American, long abandoned there by her mother in the U.S., creates a tentative bond with an alien American sailor. It's a wrenching story, one in which we witness the impossibility of love when it tries to flourish under crushing circumstances. In the story Help, a Manila International Airport official recruits his young nephews in a plot to beat up the Beatles before they board their plane out of the Philippines. Based on an actual incident involving the band and a perceived slight toward Imelda Marcos during the Fab Four's tour of the country, Help plays off the nephew's excitement to meet the Beatles against the uncle's fanatical devotion to Imelda Marcos. Both comic and tragic, the story encapsulates the prevalent concerns of the book, of family and friends left behind in the gamble of finding a better life, of difficult loves and blown opportunities, and of how these trials can make us petty, even cruel. Throughout Monstrous, Tenorio examines how we can be so close yet so far away from what we desire or need, and how that complicates the very real sense of isolation many of his immigrant characters already experience. Here's how the young narrator in Lemoore, California, whose beloved big sister has run off with her teen boyfriend, puts it. I put my head on my knees, close my eyes. Somewhere, Isa is fine without us. Here, we are fine without Isa. And this is the truth I don't want to know. That the ones who leave and the ones who get left keep living their lives, whatever the distance between. A possible consolation, as Tenorio's tender, exquisite, and even humorous stories might suggest, is in recognizing that we still carry something with us of those who have been part of our lives.
Oscar Villalone is the managing editor of the West Coast literary journal Ziziva. He reviewed Monstrous by Leslie Tenorio. California used to be home to thousands of local crop varieties. Grocery stores looked like today's farmers markets, teeming with unique fruits and vegetables. Today, only a few of those crops are still grown, but Sam Harnett visited a seed company that's recovering some of those lost heirloom varieties.
There's no way across over here. You'll see the animals and the pigs. And
farmer John Fenley has big ambitions for his new 10-acre plot of land. He's going to put an orchard up front and fill the fields with over 1,000 crop varieties. Out by the stream, the garlic's already in.
Well, what we're looking at here is all these rows were dug by hand and were created by hand. We have over 97 varieties of garlic planted. Raspberries, boysenberries, on and on the list goes.
Fenley has a farmer's build, large shoulders, a constant grin, and a passion for plants. Even before he started his sustainable seed company 3 years ago, he had a big garden. Then one day, he stumbled onto an old seed catalog from the 1980s. The pages were filled with varieties he'd never even heard of.
I think I counted 60 or 70 broccoli varieties in there, and I was just like, no way. Today, generally, there's maybe 4 or 5 broccoli varieties. So all those other varieties are gone. Holy mackerel. Those were not only flavors and taste, but disease resistance, pest resistance, and they're gone.
A few months ago, Fenley moved his seed operation to Covelo, a remote town in the northeast corner of Mendocino County. There's only one main road, a small grocery store, and no sheriff. The area is known for pot growers and doomers, people preparing for social catastrophe.
It's always been a place with pretty unique characters. I don't know how you want to put that.
The county is one of only 3 in the U.S. that bans genetically engineered crops. Fenley says the people in Covelo didn't want to depend on a big corporation for their seeds. They wanted something he calls seed sovereignty.
For this community, you know, a lot of what we heard was, if things get tough, like what happened, you know, that happened during the Depression. We want a source of seed and or food that's adapted to our area, and we're not held hostage by anyone or anything. There used to be seed companies for every little nook and cranny of this country.
Fenley is idealistic about bringing back that agricultural history. He launched his business by regrowing varieties developed a century ago by Luther Burbank, a renowned California horticulturalist. And unlike most other companies, his seeds aren't grown in China. He cultivates them right here, all organic and sustainable.
Creek, and what you can hear in the background now is the big wind turbine going.
There's a wind turbine for power, a colony of bees to pollinate the crops, and chickens and pigs to provide fertilizer. Out by the garlic field, Fenley shows me two huge refrigerated cargo containers. He's using them to store his seeds while he builds a barn. Hundreds of buckets line the shelves, each with its own variety of seed.
And you can see we're looking at honey rock melon, Ford Hook chard. The peppers are down below here. You have a Santa Fe pepper, Little Bell's pepper. There's so many different types of peppers. Peppers and tomatoes are probably the number
one. In the 1930s, big seed companies started developing hybrid varieties better suited for long hauls and mass production. Pretty soon, farmers stopped saving their seeds, and local varieties disappeared. Now Fenley says he has to scour seed banks and small farms across the state to find the old heirlooms.
Some of these varieties have been kept in people's families for 7, 8, 10 generations, and you can't buy them. And we carry some seed varieties that no one else has.
Fenley's customers aren't just gardeners. His heirloom grains are used in England to rethatch old roofs and by Bay Area bakers to make artisan breads. In the shipping room, half a dozen employees are packaging the precious seeds for online customers.
Everything's still done by hand.
Fenley hopes to change that soon. He recently found a 100-year-old seed packing machine, and he got it to run with a treadmill motor salvaged from the county dump.
It's a little cantankerous, and it takes some loving to keep it going, but it'll do the job.
Fenley's business is growing rapidly, and he says he hears of 4 to 5 new seed companies sprouting up every month. Since the economic downturn, more and more people have started their own vegetable gardens.
Humans have been doing this for hundreds of years. They've been growing their own food. They've been saving their seed from it. And there's a security in that. There's a sense of peace. You're connected not only to the land, but to your food.
Fenley rummages around on his desk, looking to show me his latest project.
That may have been filed away already. No, I haven't. There it is.
He pulls out a bag of tiny shriveled seeds.
This is a wheat. It's called Lancaster Fullcaster.
A customer found the seeds in her attic, and she hopes Fenley can regrow them. He says it won't be an easy task. The seeds are more than 90 years old. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is our technical producer. Additional engineering by Paul Encore and Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. Our senior producer this week is Victoria Maleon. The producer is Nina Thorson. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2012 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. More information is available at www.irvine.org. And the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org.